SiriusXM Sports presents
At the Races with Steve Bick.
Horse racing, handicapping,
interviews.
This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
A very good Wednesday, race fans. Series 219, XM 201, Sports Zone 964, if you're listening to Series XM online and at our website, stevebick.com. And right into hard news immediately. Jay Bribman is going to join us here virtually now. And we'll... now I've got to help provide a piece of information, so bear with me here on the opening, and I will get we'll get Jay here in a second. Obviously, the story yesterday that emerged regarding closing weekend at Oaklawn, and most prominently, Arkansas Derby winner Charlatan, and second Baffert horse Gamin, and the way in which this is unfolded. Has created the predictable firestorm of response. And there's so many moving parts to it, frankly, but, you know, the overall element of this is that it just creates a horrifically bad image, and it just... You know, it just hurts the industry at large, no matter, you know, what the specifics, you know, turn out to be. And, you know, we've talked on so many different fronts, you know, particularly over the last couple of years, that, you know, they're virtually, I know it's impossible to, you know, be incident free on all the areas of concern, meaning, you know, horse maintenance and horse safety and all the issues. But the vigilance and, you know, striving for absolute perfection has to be, you know, the watchword. And, you know, considering, you know, that Baffert Barn is, you know, the highest of the high profile, it creates a tremendous negative for everybody. And, you know, the way in which these kinds of incidents are brought through the, you know, the process, and we've discussed it for years. Alan Forman will join us at 10:30 to talk about a couple of the mechanics that are involved, and the way in which this story emerged essentially somewhat prematurely, not somewhat, but fully prematurely, because the process of lab samples and testing winners, and then usually, you know, the top finishers, and then maybe random horses, there's a, you know, a system that is employed. And, you know, that involves sending out samples, and then if samples test positive, notifying the people involved, and sending out for a split sample. And then the process of, you know, adjudicating the positive and implementing, you know, penalties, getting, you know, you may have seen some of the quotes from Bernie Hedl, long time official, and, you know, explaining the process and how they would, you know, they would work it and how, you know, all the phases of it. And that's, you know, that's the fairest way to do it, because the innuendo and particularly involving this is, you know, it's not a service to really to, you know, to anybody. Instead, you know, you get, you know, some things being, you know, assumed, and it just, you know, creates a tremendous, you know, conflagration, which is what you've got. You got to wait until the split samples come through. Everyone is focused on the two Baffert horses. There's apparently a few, some other positives that are being evaluated. You know, then there's just the appearance of impropriety, and it, you know, is just immediately assumed, and that it doesn't even matter, frankly, what, you know, what comes back now at this point, because it's just promptly, you know, if a split sample comes back and it says that you know, the first positive, you know, the first test was incorrect, well, then it's a cover up. So there just can't be any of this. You know, and the product in question, and I'll let Alan, Dr. Alde, not available today, but we'll get his lidocaine thoughts when the time comes. And, you know, lidocaine shows up in all kinds of, in all, I mean, you, all of us, you put on suntan lotion, there's going to be lidocaine in it, but it's a legal med that's got a 72-hour withdrawal time. So, I mean, for people saying, you know, for people calling it a banned substance and illegal, it's not illegal, and it's not banned. It just can't be used within 72 hours of racing. And if you want to have the discussion that there shouldn't be a single medication used for the equine athlete, that you know, they shouldn't be treated with anything. It should be nothing but holistic treatments. That's a separate conversation. Baffert on his end, and he actually, you know, expressed the frustration at and the displeasure at, you know, this not being handled in the way in which a state commission is supposed to handle them, handle these kinds of things. So he, you know, there's nothing really for him to address until the split sample comes back and the Arkansas Racing Commission, you know, offers a ruling, has a hearing, takes testimony, takes all the vet records, etc. You know, then of course there's all the, you know, the ancillary issues that are going to be associated with this, with, you know, with points. If Charlatan is disqualified and Basin moved up, you know, there's all that kind of thing. There's the complication, of course, of Charlatan, you know, losing a grade one and having, you know, having you know, days after the Arkansas Derby, you know, having been not sold, but having his stallion career established in terms of a future, and all the other things that just are associated. So the bottom line, I'm still having trouble getting Jay for some reason. Talked to him last night. And you know what? In fact, Deja, you know what we might do? We might swap Jay with, since we can't reach him, maybe with Alan, because I think Alan, I think that's what we'll do. Let me, let's try that. Let's get Alan in here first, and we'll push Jay to later in the morning. Oh, you got Jay. Very good. All right. Well, then Alan stays where he was. Jay Pribman of the Daily Racing Forum joins us, and Jay spent the whole day on the story. Jay, good morning.
Hello, Stephen.
Jay, this has been kind of a piecemeal story, and you know, essentially because it spilled out, you know, starting apparently with an Arkansas Racing Commission or somebody close to it that you know, said that let it out that there were positives associated with Arkansas Derby Day, and from there piecemeal elements started to be accrued. Talk about how you tracked the story.
Well, I had heard from someone I trust on Sunday, midway through the Santa Anita card, that there were, you know, regarding that and a couple other potential things. And, you know, there's situations like this that arise quite often, and, you know, the due diligence is just to check them out. You know, there's racetrack rumors all the time. Oftentimes they don't amount to anything, but you have to at least, you know, be sure of that and check them out. So the first thing that we did was, you know, not knowing any details or significant details, but was to contact the Santa Anita stewards. I talked to my colleague Steve Anderson and to see if he had heard anything, and we agreed that, well, let's call the Santa Anita stewards, because surely if there's some sort of a ruling on a trainer from California who'd been in Arkansas, that they'd be aware of it, and they weren't. So at that point, we were like, well, we're not 100% sure here of what's what. Then not long after, another person I trust came with similar information, but not exactly the same in terms of what was transpiring. But because it was a holiday, you know, Monday, there was really no way to contact anyone in Arkansas. So the process just basically began yesterday with following up on it. And because the one thing that I think I like to do in situations like this is make sure it's correct or there's something to it before going to the principals and seeing if there's any reaction from them. Because to call, you know, trainer X every time, you know, there's a rumble or something about him or anybody else, you know, and it turns out it's not correct, is just, you'd be there's so many racetrack rumors, you'd be calling people all the time. And you've got to make sure you have some substance to it before you reach out to them. So anyway, the process began, made phone calls to the Arkansas Racing Commission and others who may have had, knowledge of what was going on, and over the course of the day was able to put together the story that we had online yesterday.
Flesh out some of those details, Jay, as they were gathered, if you would.
Well, I mean, what we know at this point, for certain, the thing that you have to be careful about when writing any story like this is, even if you think you might know more or suspect that have been told that there might be more, you can only go with what you can confirm. And our policy at the paper is to have at least two sources that can confirm whatever you're writing. So what we could confirm as of yesterday was that there was an initial test on Charlatan that was flagged for a medication violation, and medication violations can range from an illegal medication to too much of something that is legal. I'd heard two different versions of what the situation was, but was not able yesterday with confidence to confirm which of the two situations was completely accurate. And that's why our story says a medication violation, but it's not specific to the medication. And we just didn't feel comfortable because we couldn't nail it down in that regard. But in the process regarding a medication violation is that once the parties, and this is for any situation, but since we're talking about specifically Charlatan, what happens is once the connections of a horse are they're contacted to be alerted that an initial test has been flagged, and then the Racing Commission has a list of 6 to 8 drug testing labs with which they work who do follow-up testing. They have a primary lab, but they also have then several secondary labs. And then the trainer has the option of having a split sample of the initial test tested at that second lab. So what happens is they draw enough blood and urine when the horse post-race so that and only test part of it initially so that if there's something gets flagged, they can do a follow-up test. And what happens in these cases is that once they do the follow-up test, if that follow-up test confirms what the initial test found, then that's considered a violation. If the follow-up test does not confirm the initial test, then it's not considered a violation, and it's considered that the horse tested clean. So it's unusual for the initial test results to be to get out. We'll see if the follow-up tests confirm what the initial test had. And that process will take another week to 10 days. And even at that case, there's still, gameplay this out. If the test does confirm, the second test confirms what the first test found, then the Arkansas Racing Commission would have to file a complaint. They would have to interview the trainer, anybody else connected to the horse, ranging from an assistant trainer, groom, hot walker, veterinarian, as to the events of the day and week regarding the horse to see what happened, and that would include regarding the medication, what was the route of administration Was it something that was injected, something topical, something in feed, you know, all of those things. I'm just, again, these are just sort of the hypotheses of what they have to do in a situation like this. So that's kind of where we're at here with this situation. But obviously, as I wrote in the story yesterday, there's ramifications regarding this. If it turns out the second test confirms what the first test did, there's ramifications regarding points towards the Kentucky Derby. There's ramifications regarding the Belmont Stakes in terms of purse earnings. So there's all kinds of potential dominoes to fall, you know, and others, certainly. So that's kind of the overview I can give you as of awakening this morning.
Well, and also, of course, Baffert released a statement, which was as much really as he could do, considering you know, the processes that you lay out, and you know, we'll address it when time permits, and or you know, when the system arrives at whatever station. Jay, the other horse that has not gotten obviously nearly as much attention, Gamine, for those that you know don't have only seen two horses' names associated, Gamine, you know, apparently the other. You were the one person tracking the story that reached George Bolton at a point when it was uncertain, you know, who the two horses were, and Nadal, you were helpful, discerning, that part of the story.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that was just again part of the reporting process yesterday. Was calling as many people as possible who might have knowledge of what was going on. And you know, when you, in this case, you know, when you've been told that an Arkansas Derby winner tested positive, if you can try and reach anybody who might have knowledge of either of those two horses, it's helpful. And obviously, you know, I got a hold of George, and he told me that Nadal had tested clean, so that was further confirmation that the horse in question from the Arkansas Derby that had tested positive was Charlatan. And that was obviously stuff that, you know, there was further confirmation that was accessed during the reporting process yesterday with other people who were contacted. So that was just part of the, you know, there were just a lot of phone calls and a lot of people that had to reach out to yesterday, and that was one aspect of it. But it helped obviously confirm, you know, what was going on. I saw some reporting yesterday that, you know, Nadal was one of the horses who had tested positive, which is just not correct.
There's also reports that there are other horses that are going through the same process in terms of split samples, and you know, those will come out or they won't. I mean, based on the results. And there's also the storyline, which I'll take up with Alan Foreman, regarding Truesdale Laboratories, who had been the Arkansas test lab that lost their accreditation, and not the first time, actually, that they've lost their accreditation. And I'll let Alan talk from a RMTC perspective on that process, given that the samples were sent on down the road. Jay, the thing
let's just explain. I don't know that you quite explained that. You said on
go
down
ahead.
The road. I mean, let's just explain that further. Truesdale has
sure.
been the lab for Arkansas Racing Commission, but is not anymore because they lost their accreditation. That's
right.
What you were obtusely referring to there. So that's, I just wanted to, you know, you let the, you, that was left a little unclear.
Fair enough. And I'll let Alan talk about the chain of command and possession and testing when he joins us at 10:30. You know, Jay, before we talk about what I had reached out to you yesterday morning about, which was a Derby Watch conversation. We'll get to that. The problematic element here is just the perception and that every time and particularly with the Baffert Barn that is one of the monoliths in the industry, it makes it just difficult for everybody and for the critics of the game. It gives them a battering ram, no matter what the actual outcome of something like this is.
I'm sure that's true. I'm just trying to deal with facts here, Steve. And,
sure.
The facts of the matter are this horse has an initial bad test, waiting to see if it's confirmed. If and when it's confirmed, I want to find out, what the specific medication was, how it was used. We still don't know whether from the test results how much of the medication was there. Was this horse way over the limit or barely over the limit of a legal medication, or was it given something illegal? From everything I can gather, it's a legal medication. But again, I couldn't confirm all that yesterday, but it's something that can't be in a horse's system on race day. But again, I don't know a lot of specifics about this yet. So, as far as public perception goes, I mean, that's, I'll let the public determine that. I'm just trying to deal with, facts here. And the facts are this horse has an initial bad test. And I'm waiting to see if and when it's confirmed. And then if and when it's confirmed, we'll go forward from there and judge accordingly and report accordingly.
Very good.
A horse, there's the potential that a horse who won a division of the Arkansas Derby has a bad test. I mean, that's not an insignificant story.
Right. Right.
So
we'll wait and we'll hear as this unfolds, and we'll talk about some of the mechanical elements with Alan in hour two. Jay, let's have a more pleasant topic to delve into, and that was the return of Maxfield to score off in the Matt Wynn on Saturday and confirm a lot of the expectations and confidence that Godolphin and Brendan Walsh talk about Saturday's result.
Right, yeah, so that was what you had reached out yesterday morning saying, hey, you want to come on about, I'm a little busy today. Anyway. So, yes, regarding Maxfield, I thought his race was terrific. He'd been off for so long, he was giving up recency to all his rivals in that race, and he didn't have the cleanest of trips. He was in traffic a lot of the way, so I thought that actually will serve him well down the line. I thought he got a lot of experience because of the spot he ended up in. And there was a lot to like about the race. Not only that he came back with a performance like that, but it was a career best buyer speed figure, which you would hope would happen with a horse who's grown up from 2 to 3. But I like that he broke better than he had last year. He only ran 2 times last year, so there wasn't a whole lot to go on. But in both those races, he didn't break well. And he came out of the gate really well on Saturday. And it was interesting because when I had talked last week to Brendan Walsh about Maxfield for a feature story that I wrote for the Racing Form leading up to the race, he had said that the horse had gotten a lot stronger over the time that he'd been off, and that he was hoping that that actually might translate into him coming out of the gate better, that he was just had more powerful hind end as a result of growing up. And it's exactly what happened. And he came out of the gate really well, and it put him into a forward position, which I think is something that is going to help him going forward to be there and not be out the back and have to rally through so much traffic, which he was able to do last year, but it's still, I think, more advantageous if you can be a little more forwardly placed. And he was, but he was in some traffic. And then when Jose Ortiz wheeled him out at the top of the stretch, I thought he finished extremely well. And it was just a really good, strong race to come back from. And I would say that you've got to put him right among the top contenders for the Kentucky Derby the way he ran.
We talked to Brendan on Monday, and no immediate decision making. They're taking things into consideration, and Brendan had said that he thought he would run twice more before September, and so what that ends up entailing, we'll see. But he did say, Jay, a race by. Take it a race at a time, essentially. And, the excitement factor is from the public is to get him to Belmont to face off against the likes of Tiz the Law and Nadal, et cetera. So kind of an interesting situation, to make a decision between some of the rescheduled possibilities and the reconfigured classic grade one.
Right. I mean, and that's certainly an option for him. I think the other option would be to wait for the bluegrass, which is now going to, pending approval today, which we expect to happen. It'll be run on July the 11th for Keeneland's going to have that brief meeting in the middle of July. Those are the two most obvious races on the table right now. Obviously the Belmont is a classic, even at a mile and an eighth. The aspect of that is, though, here's a horse you gave all that time to. Do you wheel him back on, not short rest, but fairly short when you look at the horizon of what you're trying to accomplish getting to September, as opposed to just waiting for the bluegrass, which is run at the track where he had his biggest win at two, winning the Breeders' Futurity. It would mean he wouldn't have to ship. It's just, what's your horizon here on what you're trying to accomplish for the rest of the year and for the long-term future of the colt? I think you'll see that in how he's managed over the next couple of months.
The variety of considerations, of course, that are involved, including the grade one versus grade two, and the one turn versus the two turn, and the timing, as you say, Jay. In addition, talk about some of the other finishers that have now quickly been added to the possibles for Belmont, including Pneumatic and New York Traffic.
So, yeah, I'm not sure Pneumatic's going to go to the Belmont. He might. Basin is possible from Asmussen's barn for the Belmont as well. But as of yesterday, Marty McGee was in touch with Steve Asmussen for us, and he said that he didn't have any firm plans at the moment for Pneumatic. I like Pneumatic's race a lot. I thought, considering it was only his third start and his stakes debut, and he was inside the whole way, never really got a breather. I thought he hung in there pretty well till the very, very end when he kind of lost his punch the last 100 yards or so, but I think that was an understandable development. And I think if he'd have been able to sit where New York Traffic was, which was stalking while three wide, he might have had a better fate. So I thought his race was very good, and I think you're going to see him improve off of it and be a fairly significant horse going through the rest of the year. New York Traffic, he ran another really solid race. He seems to fire every time. I thought in both that race and the Louisiana Derby, he did benefit from fairly soft trips in terms of a pace standpoint. And that was another thing going back to Maxfield that I liked about his race. I mean, it wasn't a real rock and roll pace in front of him that he was able to overcome and win. And by contrast, I think that the pace helped a horse like New York Traffic. That said, you know, he ran another really strong race, as he has pretty much every time out. I think he's among the better three-year-olds this year. I don't know that he's quite at the top level, but he certainly has acquitted himself well when properly spotted, and I'll be interested in seeing how they manage him. Certainly the Belmont is a possibility for him. The Bluegrass would be a possibility, and the race I think would really suit him would be something like the Haskell with his style and the way that Monmouth usually plays. And the Haskell this year is a week after the Bluegrass, so you'd either run it one or the other if you decided to wait till then.
Attachment rate ran kind of evenly, and in fact, it was fourth at all points of call, which you don't see that often. Beaten about five lengths, picks up a few more points, has got 15, and Dale Roman's never saw a Bluegrass he didn't like. But we'll see what he does with attachment rate, who seems to be, you know, seems to have some talent. We'll see, you know, if he can, you know, take it, dial it up a notch. You know, he's never been worse than fourth in five starts. Jay, of course, with the expanded notation analysis of the Matt Wynn, and always edifying. And there's always some hints, Jay, that you some kernels of wisdom that you instill in there, those charts.
Well, hopefully so. I mean, I like to keep it so that not only are we looking at potential Derby horses, but trying to evaluate the merits of horses who are also rans in the race in terms of, you know, do they belong at this level? Are they horses that might improve going towards the Derby, or are they horses who might need a different spot? Like the horse you just brought up, for instance, attachment rate, I really think he's just a better horse around one turn. And I think that's going to be proven out over his career. He kind of will loom up and hang a little bit when he goes two turns, but he finishes his 7/8 and one turn mile races off a lot better, and I think that that's going to be his comfort zone for the bulk of his career. I can't blame anybody at this stage of the game for continuing to, you know, try with you know, to make the Derby with a good 3-year-old, but so, you know, that horse specifically was one that I wrote about in my recap, that I just really think he's a better horse around one turn, and I'd be interested in seeing if they do try him another two-turn race and he performs like I think he will, if they decide maybe to look at something like, hypothetically, the Alan Jerkins during the summer at Saratoga, which is a grade 1/7 race, which I think for that horse is going to be a better chance for him to get a grade one than trying, you know, a two-turn race. He's an intriguing horse. I don't know if they're going to do it, but to me, he'd be an intriguing horse in the Belmont. I don't know that I don't think he's as good as Tis the Law or Nadal, but I think that kind of a configuration is a better chance for him to win at a mile and an eighth than if he were to run in, you know, say the Bluegrass Stakes.
On that topic, actually, of shortening up, some consideration we're hearing too that Charlatan actually may end up in the Woody Stevens. That's a spot that we'll see. We'll see how all the rest of this, of course, shakes out. But given the sort of mumblings about, you know, distance limitations, be interested to see what happens on that front.
There's, as we were alluding to at the top of this segment, there's other things that need to play out first regarding Charlatan.
Exactly. Jay, otherwise, stories and some of the three-year-old action with the dates firming up and the official formal request by Keeneland for those 5 days in July. And it feels like we've got a path to September now that is quickly firming. Saratoga being the kind of the last key element, it would seem.
Right. I mean, we're going to have the Santa Anita Derby in a week and a half, the Belmont in 3.5 weeks. As you mentioned, the date for the Bluegrass has now been firmed up. And we'll see what Saratoga does, you know, most specifically, and I think compellingly regarding the Traverse, because if it's left at its traditional date, it's just going to be too soon in front of the Derby for horses to run in both. And I would expect that it would get moved so that horses could potentially participate in both. And I know that, you know, for instance, a horse like Tis the Law, that would be a dream for Barkley Tagg. Would be, he's pointing for the Belmont now, but if he could go Belmont, Travers, Derby, with spacing that would provide for that, I'm certain that that would be his path, as one example.
Right. And it makes sense from everything we've heard from, as well from Jack Knowlton and from Barkley Tagg. The horse still has to come up from Florida and take up residency in New York. And, Jay, you mentioned the Santa Anita Derby, and we had a visit from Michael McCarthy on Monday, following up Smooth Like Straight's nice win at Churchill in the nightcap, and that coming in the war chant. And he was talking about... I brought up Rushy with him, and that was a name that we added to the Santa Anita Derby list with Authentic and an Honor AP.
Yeah, it's going to probably be a small field. The other horses that I'm expecting to run are Azul Coast, who's like Authentic, is trained by Baffert, and Shooter Shoot for Peter Erton, who was supposed to run in one of the divisions of the Arkansas Derby, but had a minor hiccup that week and had to be withdrawn. He's back at Santa Anita and training for the race. And so I would expect those horses to be in there as well. But with Authentic and Honor AP, who are two of the real top three-year-olds in the country, let alone out here in California, there aren't many who want to, I think, take them on. And I wouldn't expect a very big field for that race. But regardless, this is a race that those two horses, Authentic and Honor AP, were pointing for, you know, when it was back on its original date of April the 4th. So just being able to run in the race at last, even if it's been postponed by a couple of months, I think is going to be welcomed by the connections of both of those colts.
Well, Jay, I appreciate the report first thing this morning regarding the situation and the Arkansas Derby, and we'll wait for, you know, the factual elements to play out among the next steps.
Yep. No, we'll just see. We'll see where it goes.
Jay Privman, everybody, DRF Privman. And we'll talk to you Friday, right?
Sure. I don't know about what, but we'll figure something out.
Well, I want to recap, I know you covered the Shoemaker story and some of the good racing from Monday, and got a couple more graded stakes this weekend as well at Santa Anita, and plus the whatever else happens in the next 48 hours, Jay. It's a thrill ride. It's a thrill a minute. Jay, thanks a lot.
All right, Steve. Thanks. Talk to you then.
Jay Privman, everybody. We'll stay right here. And I didn't want to break because I know that Pete is going to be tied up at 10. So we get 15 minutes with Pete Fornatale looming boldly. Good morning, Pete.
Good morning to you, my friend. A nice little break from homeschooling this morning, learning about the beaches of the world today.
It's
kind of a fun little thing they have. It's a program, a little interactive website with these little mini books, and first the kids listen to the books and then they read them. So it's all in Spanish. I have just enough Spanish to understand what she's talking about, describing the the beach in Hawaii with the volcanic ash that makes the sand black. It's making me long to travel, I have to say, reading this thing. And then they go through and they answer questions. So it's a fun little assignment she's got going today. But she's on her own up there recording into the computer. So I snuck down to the bunker to have a chat with you for a few minutes.
Excellent. Perfect. Last week, I'll tell you, considering Pete, how little, supposedly how little, racing, we've got, even with the addition of quite a few venues, there's just, the things just pile up quickly. And so we didn't get a chance to connect last week. But one story that I'm sensing, just kind of watching the contest scene and the contest players. Are we approaching a revolt against the live decision contests where, people that are down a touchdown with seconds remaining, throw Hail Marys. It feels like there's a lot of irked players saying, enough of this. Pick and pray and, weigh your options and play your cards and live with them.
It's interesting. This is a debate where I've been aware of it for a long time. I've always had the view that both formats have their place in the world. And basically the way I look at it is, for the everyday player, somebody who's playing contests five times a week, and we're talking about a 12-race online contest, I have no doubt in my mind that the pick and pray format is better for those players. The problem is, in terms of introducing a new player to the game and trying to get somebody into racing, I feel like the pick and pray compared to the live format for somebody you're trying to get excited about racing, frankly, it's boring. There's not as much excitement. There's something really fun in a live contest about being able to play that game within a game. And I think that live contests will always have a place, and I see it as two ways. One, I think they're terrific, again, for newer players and certain type of feeders. I always love the game theory and trying to block and strategize and do things like that. There is a frustration with those late Hail Marys, if you will. And as prizes get bigger, I would love to see more formats that make that do creative things like we tried to do back in the RF tournaments days, where if you want to have a bigger money live format contest, do it with cut lines, either halfway through a day or do it from one day to another. Make people earn the right to be there. If you've had to make some tough decisions and clear hurdles in advance, you've earned the right to make that that Hail Mary at the end, even if you are somebody on the outside looking in. So I do think for bigger online contests, there are some creative things that can be done. And I get why everyday players prefer the pick and pray. My other issue with the pick and pray, again, I understand the merits of it, but not only is it not as good of a marketing tool, but I feel like if we're thinking of these as handicapping contests, you can't call it handicapping if you're divorcing the pick you're making from the odds. You know what I mean? I mean, the pick and prays are they're terrific, pure picking contests, but you don't know what price the horse is going to be. So it's that, to me, that skill of being able to zigzag according to where the value is, when you take that completely out of the equation, you do lose something, in my opinion. I've never seen the format I'm about to describe, and I think it would be logistically difficult, but I'd be super interested in a contest that was pick and pray, but the values were fixed. In other words, let's say you got the morning line or whatever. Yes, it's going to some degree become an exercise in finding an accurate line. But it's the same playing field for everybody in that scenario. And then I think you could more accurately call it a handicapping contest. Interestingly, I think in a way what I'm describing, and I didn't realize this until we started talking about it, but I think in a way the format I'm asking for is a little bit more similar to the fantasy style that the folks at Stable Duel are getting ready to unleash. They did the contest back at Breeders' Cup, where you're purchasing your team of horses based on fixed prices. So maybe that's something that some of the folks who are unhappy about the live format would be interested in checking out, especially folks who already have a predilection towards fantasy sports. But for me, at the end of the day, they each have their place, and I get it. If you're talking about big money and you're talking about a relatively short amount of races, for example, in our Horse Players Happy Hour last week, we did, and it was an actual qualifier to the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge. We gave away a $10,000 Breeders' Cup seat, but it was eight races, so it was, to me, that made it a no-brainer. That's got to be pick and play. Otherwise, you know, one horse and is enough to qualify. And, you know, you just want to come up with ways in these contests to make it so that no one, in an ideal world, no one result is going to prove definitive. That's why there's caps, for example, in contests. You want to try to find ways where you can really reward somebody doing the work over a period and making good decisions over a period of races, as opposed to having one aberrant result. So that's my very long-winded analysis of the situation. I would imagine the folks you're hearing from complaining, Steve, are folks who are very experienced contest players playing every day, getting frustrated that somebody comes and beats them in the last race with a long shot. Is that accurate?
Well, it's more observational, you know, just watching reaction to results, you know, especially when there's, and we have had over the last couple of weeks, the first two weekends at Churchill, particularly, you know, with the narrow choice of venues, and maybe some of this will die down in another 2-3 weeks when we're, you know, looking at 20 different racetracks again, and there'll be, you know, a wider array of tracks involved in the selection process. But with so much focus on Churchill in particular, you've had, I mean, what's today? We've had we've had six cards at Churchill, and five of them have, finished up with literally five of the races. Five of the days ended with a big priced winner at the end. And there was the 70-1 cap horse of Charlie the Prestige another day. So, you know, you've had, it just so happens, in fact, I'm going to pull it out right here. You had a 7-1. Hold it. Right. So was that a 7-1? Well, you had the Harry Lynch horse on, was that Monday? That was Monday at 40-1. You had the 73-1 Le Presti and the 7-1 D'Amato back to back to close out Churchill on Sunday. Saturday, McCarthy with the 5-1, but then 8-1 the week before and 22-1 before that. I mean, there's been a bunch of these, and so it just seems like the rash of prices has resulted in that, you know, reverb.
I had another idea as you were talking. It's probably too Byzantine, but there'd be a logic to shortening up the cap in the last race or maybe last two races of a contest. Now, to do it in the fairest possible way, I think of schoolyard basketball of this, that you can, this is too Byzantine, I can know just as I'm saying it, but just for a thought experiment, you can play a long shot in the last leg of a contest or the second to last leg of a contest, but you have to call it beforehand, like the bank shot. That it would be, from a fairness point of view, it'd be really interesting. Because I hate the idea, what if somebody happens to love, you know, we all love 20-1 shots sometimes in these contests. It'd be pretty rotten to only get, you know, 6-1 on a horse you genuinely like that's 20-1. So I like the idea that you could play that horse, but you have to say so before the tournament starts. Yeah. And then once you get there, you make whatever. We'd have to figure out what it would be, but a 6-1 or 8-1 cap maybe in the last leg. It would prevent the stabbing that makes people so crazy. Just a little thought experiment there for you and the listeners.
If this continues, if this rash of prices continues, there's going to be the appropriate amount, or the the equal amount of geschreying will go on. We'll see what the ramifications are. And you know, you mentioned the Friday happy hours, which have been so much fun and have kept everybody engaged. And in fact, on Friday had Pete Rotondo in advance of, or actually Monday, in advance of the broadcast and the kickoff to the Breeders' Cup Win in Your In series, the challenge races. And Pete said, he said, as long as you guys are up for it, they'll continue. And they've been really well received. And I got a question and a request from JK, from Jonathan, for some tidbits on a mutual friend who's going to be part of the Jonathan plus one long interview. When's that drop? Tomorrow?
Yes. Can we say who it is, or is he keeping it under wraps? I think we can say the Hammer himself, who does such a great job on at the races with you, Steve, so often, and obviously has an amazing history and a lot of great stories from his time in the game. These JK plus one shows, I mean, I've kind of created them. A monster here, Steve, but I feel like since I did pluck Jonathan from obscurity, I can take credit for reflected glory for how nice a job he's done lately with the likes of Marshall Graham and Duke Matisse and Mike McCarthy. And, I mean, every show he's done has been terrific, and this show coming up with Hammer is going to be no exception. I think it's dropping today, if I'm not mistaken. Oh, maybe he's recording. I think it's dropping today. I think it's going to be out very soon in your feed. Folks can find that over at InTheMoneyPodcast.com. And you mentioned the Horse Player Happy Hours. We're keeping them going. We're back to doing the regular feeder, so folks can get in for very short money, little $20 feeder. Folks can start their way to the $10,000 Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge this Friday. Going to be tough to top the action last Friday, where we had a thrilling finish with Russ Priola just getting the nod over Rich Chinamo in a nice Paisan Exacta that I was joking with Peter Rotondo about. It was a lot of money on the line, $15,000 between the full seat and the partial, just at the top of that leaderboard. We won't have that kind of money flying around, but we will have some fun. Going to be starting at about 3 o'clock. That can be found on Periscope, on Twitter. You can follow that from my At Looms Boldly feed, from the Breeders' Cup feed, from JK's feed, from Matt Bernier's feed, or over at the Breeders' Cup Facebook page. Those have been incredibly well attended, Steve, and I definitely credit your support, both talking about it on the show here and also on Twitter, with the very impressive numbers that have been of people who have been participating and watching along. We encourage everybody to do the same.
Well, and it's been, as we discussed with Peter on Monday, with everybody, locked down and with a dearth, at least, for the 2 months, it's loosening up now. But, at a time when everybody was just, and I don't want to say entertainment starved, because you can find, entertainment and, people are also encouraged to crack a book. There's
Betting
plenty
to
keep you.
Left.
There you go. And I can't wait. We're inching closer to getting Dave Hill back on because the vapors is going to end up on the New York Times bestseller list. And he got a recommendation from the Times the other day that was stunning. They had a I don't know if you saw this, a list of upcoming releases, literary releases, and they cleverly said, if you liked this book, you might like this one, and they paralleled The Vapors to Midnight in the Garden of Good and
Ooh,
Evil.
Nice. And John Barron.
I
on
mean,
the bestseller list for 5 years.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. That recommendation as sent. I would have loved to have been in the room and seeing Dave Hill respond when he came across.
When he said
it.
That
It's unbelievable.
I'm like tingling with excitement. I can't imagine what it feels like to be the author of a book that garners such praise. And I'm glad you reminded me. I need to get a galley. I'd love to. Obviously, you're going to do the definitive sit down with him. And I'll wait and hear that first. But if you leave any meat left on the bone, I'll have him. I'll find an angle and have him on, and we'll do something different. Just because I want to, you know, everything we can do to help promote that book. It's so personal. He's such a good writer, a companionable fellow as well. And anything I can do to help Dave Hill is something I'm going to pursue.
Well, he just the other morning. Was it on Sunday? I can't remember if it was Sunday. It was either Sunday or maybe it was after the show on Monday, and I went to my inbox, and there was, you know, one of his postcards from Hot Springs, which you can sign up for, and there, you know, it's just a treat. It's like, you know, receiving a candygram from Mongo, and I open up the, you know, I open up the email, and he addressed this, you know, what happened, and it turned out that Midnight in the Garden was one of the, you know, sort of root source concepts and the way it's written that you know helped him and was part of, you know, his formatting for the Vapors. And it's a fascinating commentary about how he approached writing the book, and it's going to be tremendous.
That's a big thing in publishing. Publishers, it's funny. You probably heard a minute ago, Susan, I was down in the bunker for a minute. I snuck down there. Susan, that's become her office during the school day. So she came down there and was eager to boot me out because she has an important launch meeting today. And I was going over at breakfast her notes for the launch. And that's exactly the way these publishing presentations work, Susan, working in children's book publishing. But the idea is very much the same. You get the sales force all jacked up by, you give the description and some key sales points, and then those comp titles are so important. And we were just going over them for her, the books on the list she's about to launch. And I could just see in the publishing meeting them saying, hey, remember Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil? Here's a very different type of story, but that uses some of the same techniques and can maybe tap into some of the same audience by trying to recreate this place with these quirky characters that it's so America, but you almost can't believe it's America. All these things that I'm sure are the common elements. It's there. The publishing people fantasize about getting the New York Times to say that kind of thing about their books. So that's super cool. I can't wait to read it.
Well, and I you know, took the exit ramp there, surprisingly, when I said crack a book, and it made me think of that. But, you know, to round it all up, to round it all out, I mean, it was part of the Breeders.
Exactly. Or book we'll be talking about.
Exactly. And, you know, as I said to Peter Rotondo, between the happy hour and which caters obviously to players and contest players specifically, but the Thursday cocktails and conversation with Nick Luck and Pete and Brittany Erton, that has been really well received as well, and it's got a kind of a different MO and a different a different format and a different audience. I'm sure there's crossover, but
you're talking to the crossover. I love what they've been doing, and bringing in a little bit of lifestyle elements. Some fantastic drinking content as well. I always enjoy that. Speaking of Nick, did you hear? This shocked me. Wesley Ward was on with Nick on Luck on Sunday, and is sending a team to Royal Ascot, apparently. He will not be going, but he is going to be sending horses, which made me very excited, I have to say. I was assuming we wouldn't have any American runners this year. But
Graham Motion said on Monday the very high, with no clear assignment for her, over the next, little while, very much exploring and leaning
Coronation,
toward going with Sharing.
Yeah. Oh my God, that'd be great. I remember them saying that. I just sort of assumed this was out the window, and that part of the reason that people from America want to go there, understandably, is to get the whole Ascot as an owner experience, which is you know, unlike as great as going as a fan is, going as an owner is supposed to be even better. But that's great news. I didn't even realize that. I'll pass that knowledge along to my friends at Sky Sports Racing. They'll be very excited to hear. And best of all, Steve, I may have just booked 5 days of work.
There you go. Absolutely.
They might need me
easily.
I was assuming I'd be out.
Pete, I appreciate it, and enjoy the week. And next week will be there's a chance we'll be coming to you from somewhere in Elmont. We'll see about that. And you know, week from today, we get the start of the delayed Belmont Spring Summer Meet, and there'll be even more to delve into. So stay safe, and we'll talk next week.
Sounds good, my friend. Can't wait.
Pete Fornatel looms boldly, and the In the Money Players podcast, and all of the fun and information, and there's actually a bunch of things. Maybe we'll do it next week with Pete. I want to catch up on what Benny South Street's doing with his trip notes project and information that he's launching, which seems just invaluable, and a new layer of information available to players. So we'll do that next week. Let's take a timeout. We've gone right from the opening bell. And when we come back, Sid Fernando, Sire Watch, Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill & Dale. Sid joins us, and then we'll visit with Alan Foreman. We'll get you acquainted with some of the mechanics if you don't understand the way things are supposed to work with racing commissions and their testing procedures and the way positives are called. And I want him to talk about the accreditation issue that's tied to the Arkansas Derby Day positives. So Alan Foreman to help things. Jim Rupp, as promised yesterday, Rupp Racing, and Jim with Owendale, and great way to start the season. And Rupp is a fairly new owner, 3-4 years, but has had some very nice success. I remember Al Masti, I think, was probably the first stake, the first graded stake winner. So we'll talk to Jim Rupp and Seth Merrow in the last half hour too. Back after this at the races.
The latest racing news. It's at the races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
If you are racing 2-year-olds in California, Kentucky, please consider Bleeder Shield, the leading all-natural paste used to greatly reduce or eliminate EIPH. The list of trainers who trust Bleeder Shield is endless. Shouldn't you join the team? To learn more, contact Joseph Vellante at 215-501-6880.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Here in Pennsylvania, we have the best breeding program in the country, thanks in part to our Racehorse Development Trust Fund. It's a trust, it's not tax dollars, and by law, our fund is completely protected. These are difficult days for all of us. When life in America gets back to normal, and it will, our PA breeding program will be here, stronger and better than ever. To learn more about how we're protecting the trust, go to PABred.com to watch a short video.
How's it going, Sue?
Hey!
Have you seen this commercial?
What career track are you on?
University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program can prepare you for an exciting career in racing. Turn your passion into a paycheck.
Isn't that the horse racing school that Bob Baffert went to?
Yeah, Todd Fletcher, too, and lots of other major players in every area of the industry.
Really?
Like what?
Well, for starters, we have graduates who are executives at Churchill Downs, NYRA, Darley America, Gulfstream, Keeneland, you name it. They're also regulators, racing officials, bloodstock agents, track announcers. My class had a job placement rate of almost 90%.
Wow, what other college program has results like that?
What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. Enroll today and get on track for success. Nearly 90% of our students are employed in the racing industry immediately upon graduation. For scholarship opportunities and more, check out our website at ua-rtip.org.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
We're back at the races past the hour, the top of the hour. Sid Fernando joining us, Sire Watch Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hillendale and